music alone can cause deliverance. The Bible supports that. It's just one of the greatest gifts for worship. So I think it's a shame that the music industry commodifies that.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hi, and welcome to The Profile on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Emma Fowle. The Profile is a show where we talk with a well-known Christian about their life, their faith, and their ministry. It is brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. And if you'd like to check out more great content from the magazine, then please do head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for an exclusive half-price subscription offer. Today on The Profile, I'm speaking to singer-songwriter Philippa Hannah. As well as sharing her story of how she found Jesus, we chat about self-esteem and the music industry, what it's like to live your life on a stage, and receiving unsolicited parenting advice. So I'm delighted to be joined today on The Profile by Philippa Hannah. Thank you so much for being with us, Philippa.
Excited to be here.
Now, lots of our audience might know you from your many, many years of touring Christian events as a singer and a songwriter and as an author. But today we're going to be talking a little bit about your life story, about your faith journey and about your ministry more widely. So can I just start? I'll ask you the question we always ask everyone. Could I ask you about your growing up years? Did you grow up in a Christian home, and what did it look like for you to journey towards Jesus?
I didn't grow up in a Christian home, no. So my earliest memories are my mum being a primary school teacher, and she was phenomenal at that, and she was kind of the arts and drama person as well. So she was always very arty. We were always drawing, painting, collecting pine cones, and, you know, she was teaching her children the Joseph songs, and she was phenomenal. She was also kind of a closet Christian, my mum. So she grew up, she loved Sunday school. She loved going to church when she was little and always had a Bible by the bed. She was very sympathetic towards faith, but we never went to church as a family. My dad has always been an entertainer. So I grew up watching him in social clubs, holiday parks, places like that. Places like Butlins. He never did Butlins, but places like that. Skeg Vegas, you know, those kind of places. And he was a phenomenal entertainer. He's Irish, so his repertoire would often be folk songs, country songs, Irish, as well as all the fantastic 60s, 70s music. And I just grew up thinking my dad was as famous as Elvis and that he was a superstar. And I remember just getting dragged up on stage with him, like as early as probably 18 months old, before I could really talk, I think. And then my first stage experience for myself, I was about 2 years old, and I was in a talent competition at one of these holiday parks, and it wasn't a good experience. Oh, I literally went to pieces, ended up crying, because when you get on stage, of course, it's not what you think it's going to be. All you can really see is the lights. Mm. So it's quite disorientating. And I think I was carried off crying.
Oh.
So that was my first experience of show
business. It obviously didn't put you off, though.
It did put me off. Like, it took me ages to get back on stage. I think the next time I was about 10, so a whole decade passed. And that wasn't a good experience either, because my mic kept feeding back. And then I discovered songwriting at age maybe 13. Actually, I always made up songs, just like my little girl does now. But at 13, I got a keyboard for Christmas and figured out how to program the keyboard to sing songs to it. And yeah, I became a bit like a songwriting machine. Every day I would write a song or two even. And that was my childhood, really, watching Dad on stage. I did have, always had struggles socially. I think the school I went to a little school in Barnsley, was in quite a rough area. The families were very different to mine, although, to be honest, I've never met a family like mine, if I'm honest. But it was an area where a lot of families were on, you know, welfare, or whatever we call it, benefits, things like that. And a lot of the families had problems. And so I remember them taking the mick out of me for being posh, which I absolutely wasn't. But, you know, making fun of my accent, making fun of my Irish dad. And because I was, you know, like a twirling, singing, little sort of little dramatic kid, I was a target. So I was a target for bullying and teasing from a young age. And I think that really impacted my self-esteem as a young person. Really made me want to be liked. It was like my main goal in life was to be liked, to make some friends at some point. And when I started high school, that was like my prime goal was to be accepted, which I think is true of many young people.
Yeah.
And that led me into a lot of trouble, really, because I got in with the wrong crowd. And also, you know, I think now it's probably quite obvious, or would be quite obvious to teachers, that I'm neurodivergent, clearly ADHD, and just really was amazing at anything creative, anything that required planning, organization. I wasn't great at, which you've now experienced firsthand from me. Guys, I forgot about the this whole thing yesterday. This should have happened yesterday.
It's all right. We've rescheduled. We're all on it now.
And Emma's very gracious, so she's wiped it from her memory, just like the Lord. Yeah, as far as the East is from the West. It's as far as he's moved my ADHD mistakes from me. What was I saying?
We were talking that you went off a little bit off the rails as a teenager, trying to fit in with the crowd.
Yeah, trying to fit in with the crowd. Also struggling academically because of an inability to focus in class, which was, you know, so by the time I left school, I felt like a bit of a failure, to be honest. Like it just hadn't gone well. And then I ended up in a few relationships that weren't healthy. Actually, the last of those relationships is probably what led me into a church, because I was so poorly by that point with my mental health, and I'd been trying to get signed, going to auditions, facing a lot of rejection. Life just felt like a non-starter for me up to the age of 19, 20. I'd had a little bit of success in songwriting, a tiny bit. You know, I had had releases, which for an 18-year-old is quite good, I suppose. But yeah, I was not in a great place. And I used to go to this jam night in Preston on a Tuesday night, which I helped to run, which was phenomenal. Like it was just quirky people singing original songs, just, you know, every walk of life was in there. And I met this guy who had just become a Christian. Like he was just becoming a Christian, like right then, around that month that we met. And I saw this odd transition in him, you know, like he was so, like this guy, his name's Rue, I still know him now, he's a guitarist. He was just so full of life. And I just was super jealous of that, you know, that spark that he had. And so I became friends with him. He started playing guitar for me. He dragged me to his baptism and I met his pastors and was like, wow, there's more of these people. There's more of these shiny, happy people. And they just really started to love me, you know, and invest in me. And all of that little Christian network, Rue's friends, I met some of those guys. They were just like, Philippa, you know, you were made for a purpose. And they said such lovely things to me. And eventually, after chatting with them a lot, arguing them about the age of the universe and dinosaurs and other faiths, you know, all the questions and arguments that agnostic people probably would have with Christians, had all of them, but they just continued to pray for me, show up for me, be friendly with me. And eventually they invited me to this little tiny concert in Sheffield, which actually wasn't a concert, it was a worship night. One guy named Godfrey Birtle, some of your listeners, viewers will know Godfrey. And he just sang some songs about Jesus and it really stirred me. Found myself asking Jesus into my life.
Wow.
And it wasn't an official altar call. Like nobody said, put your hands up with every eye closed, nothing like that. I was just like, God, if you're real, like I really need to start over, because I've got a 5-year-old now and we are identical. Like honestly, it's scary how similar we are. And I see how carefree she is, how full of joy she is. That was me. Mm-hmm. And something about that period from probably age 10, 11 to age 20 just robbed me of that for so many reasons. And so I asked God into my life in hopes that he could restore that. And he did.
Wow.
He did.
What a beautiful story. And I really love the kindness of God that he met you as someone who loves writing music in the words of someone else's music, that was the thing that sort of took you absolutely, over the edge into like a relationship with Jesus. That's so beautiful.
And I think there was more than just, I think the whole journey was marked out by him. Even the stuff that's not been good, not that he caused it, but that he certainly knew he'd be able to use it. Being teased, feeling like I don't fit in, all of those things, they've actually become my calling cards in life. Singing songs that, you know, Premier has played over the years, like Arrow and Raggedy Doll, about feeling odd, different, struggling to find belonging, but then finding your purpose and identity in Christ. Suddenly you go from being like an awkward misfit to being like a beautiful anomaly that God has perfectly crafted.
Mm. And that is a real sort of hallmark of what you do on stage even now, isn't it? I can see, you know, I've seen you perform many years down at Creation Fest, which is where we first met. I've watched my daughters grow up listening to your music and loving your music and coming home with their signed Philippa Hannah CDs and feeling as a mother myself so grateful that there are people doing what you do that are prepared to be a role model in that space to young girls who are looking for something in the music industry that isn't just all bikinis and you know, the less positive images that we do sometimes see in secular music. What is it that you hope that, you know, you want to communicate through your music to girls that might be in the position that you were as a teenager?
Yeah, girls and anyone, boys too. Really just that you were created for a purpose and that you're actually been custom crafted by the master designer, the only designer. And he's very intentional about everything, from your personality, your likes, your dislikes, your look. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said that I'm like a perfect subscriber to that truth as well, because it's a journey and different seasons of our lives introduce new reasons to be insecure, don't they? You know, you just, when you think you're happy in your body, you just have a baby, don't you? or you know, your life changes. You hit perimenopause, whatever, things start to change. So it's like a constant walk with God to understand that he created you and he can work through you and will work through you if you let him.
Hmm. And that is a very particular challenge, I think, probably for someone like yourself who lives their life in the public eye, isn't it? How has your faith helped you to navigate that journey through music?
Well, like, you know, one of the symptoms of OCD, right, which is something that I've had all my life. It showed up about the age of 10 with a sort of obsessive behaviors and intrusive thoughts. And it really tracked with puberty, got worse around the age of 13, got better. And then around the time that I had my first baby, my first and only baby, I found that it came back with a vengeance in pregnancy and postpartum. So very connected to my hormones. But one of the symptoms of OCD is, or can be, looking for reassurance about things. So Googling things frantically, health symptoms, or Googling whatever it might be that you're fixating on. The word of God is amazing to fixate on. It actually, it's so there for you. And whether it's self-doubt, identity, purpose, look, even as we, like many, many people listening or watching, might be entering retirement or might be long into retirement and thinking, why am I still here? Am I redundant now? Or, you know, being in the public eye, as you said, there's always younger people, people who look better, sound better. If it wasn't for the word of God, I'd be in a very dark place. Mm. Because the word of God can continually reassure us of our identity, purpose, and value.
Yeah. And you were talking earlier a little bit about, even before you became a Christian, having releasing records and being signed. What were your experiences of working in the secular music industry?
Some of it was good. I love creatives. Creatives are amazing. Creatives, for me, they make the world the colourful place that it is a lot of the time by their strangeness, you know, their beautiful weirdness, their ability to think outside the box. I loved floating around into producers' spaces, studios, loved all of that. What I didn't like was the bluntness of people sometimes when they would give feedback. They didn't necessarily have a pastoral nature, people in power. So they wouldn't, you know, think twice about telling you, you need to lose weight, you need to change your appearance, you need to wear less clothes. And even just, it's just objectification, isn't it? The music industry. The music industry objectifies what is essentially kind of sacred, people and music. Music is one of the greatest gifts God has given us. I really believe that for many reasons. I think it's got a spiritual dimension to it. Music alone can cause deliverance. You know, the Bible supports that. And then, you know, it's just one of the greatest gifts for worship. So I think it's a shame that the music industry commodifies that. And it can be soul destroying because creatives are so sensitive. So when you take, you put your heart and soul, I'm going through it right now because I'm about to put out a new body of work, a new record, and just having to write posts about it and, you know, do scheduled reels on Instagram. And it's really hard. Because then you start to look at how many likes and shares and reposts did it get, and is it connecting with people? And it's a tough walk, but that is even more hard in the secular because the only the only way to sort of value it is on those things. People don't really go, well, you know, 10 people were really moved by it. No, it's like, if it's not hitting those marks, it's gone, it's out. So I think it's, the objectification of the sacred, in summary.
Although I guess, you know, the Christian music industry is not without its critics, especially in recent years, isn't it? So, it's always difficult, I guess, when there's money involved, because there are those demands that, whether it's books or records or whatever creative output it is, it has to be valued and paid for somehow, doesn't it? And sometimes that does sort of cross into territory that can be uncomfortable for Christians. So how do you go into those spaces and sort of where's your theology around that? Like, how do you keep your integrity, and what experiences have you had of the Christian music industry?
I think I'm quite good at this now, actually. I just always tell myself it's only life, you know? It's not the be-all and end-all. As much as big platforms can be exciting, It's all going to burn, right? All of our industries, all of our achievements, we're not taking any of that with us. And so just keeping perspective is really important. I've been reading Ecclesiastes. It's my favourite book of the Bible.
Is it?
Yeah. And just how it just goes on and on and on about, you know, all this striving, trying to achieve things, trying to build your own kingdom, trying to build your own empire. It's just a chasing after the wind. It's literally going to dissolve when we get to it. And in a long enough timeline, everybody, even the biggest stars, are obsolete. Their stardom is obsolete. Their being is eternal. Their soul is eternal. But their Grammys will not be remembered.
No.
By anyone. Even in a short space of time. And, you know, I am 42 this weekend, and already, like, I'm aware that people that were the biggest stars for me when I was 12 are forgotten by a new generation. They're like, Britney who? You know? It happens fast. So it's kind of like trying to maintain an old soul at all times. Just, you know, it ain't that much of a big deal, all this. The best we can possibly hope for is to take some souls with us by what we do.
So as someone who actually spends their life touring and performing at festivals and events, and you've probably got a full rota coming up this summer, how do you defend the Christian platform in that case?
How do we defend it? It's an opportunity. It's a resource. It's a currency as well. So one of the reasons why, like, having a modicum of fame, if you want to use that word, or influence is probably a better word, is that it's a currency. So I've always been aware that after you've been on a platform, even if it's in front of 100 people, the people in the pews, if you've done a good job, your opinion will matter to them. So someone queues up with their 14-year-old and they whisper in my ear, "She's really struggling right now. Thank you for the concert. Thank you. Will you sign the book?" And so I pick up the book and I write in there something like, "You're going to be okay. You're fearfully and wonderfully made." Or I'll say to them, "Listen, I know you're going through something hard, but look, if he can sort me out, God can sort you out. If he can release me into a life of purpose, he can release you into a life of purpose." I'm aware that because of that platform, those words just, they hit harder and they just land with a bit more juice.
Mm.
So for that reason, it's got value.
Mm. It's a big responsibility though. Does it ever weigh on you? Do you ever feel the weight of that responsibility being someone who's looked up to or a role model in some way?
Yes and no. It's good because it makes me think about my choices really carefully. Mm. Whether it's what I post on Facebook or whether it's, you know, how many glasses of wine I drink. Mm. Like, it makes a difference to the choices I make. I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing. But at the same time, I know that ultimately, they're not my responsibility. They're God's responsibility. And nobody's perfect. I think it's important to, and I think we can do better at this, actually, Christians in general, at being vulnerable and saying, you know, being open about not being perfect. Because a lot of platform Christians can appear like super holy. Like we did, I think it was a BBC Songs of Praise recording a few weeks ago. And I was there with Noel Robinson. Who else was there? Lucy Grimble. There was a few of us, Andy Flanagan. And whoever was putting biscuits in our room said something like, They touched some dirty cups and went, "Oh, these are holy," or something like that. I was like, honestly, you have no idea.
Yeah.
We literally, everybody in this room is exactly the same as every other person. That perception is super interesting. Just because we lead worship doesn't mean we're any better than your own teenagers or, you know. We're all a work in progress, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think you really do embody like that spirit of sort of, you share very openly on social media, on the platforms that you're on, when you perform in your sets, and I think you're right. I think it's really brilliant when Christians can have those honest conversations, particularly in high profile places. Has there ever been a point in your life where that's been particularly costly for you? You thought, actually, I don't know if I want to put so much of myself out there.
The only time it really started to bother me was when I had Ozma, my little girl, and I realised that as I was sharing my struggles, it was like I was inviting unsolicited advice.
Oh, the old unwanted parenting advice.
Yeah.
Oh, what a classic.
And it was the first time I'd ever really encountered that, like people just stampeding with their advice. Do this, don't do that, do this. Even like zooming in on pictures of what she was eating and, "She shouldn't be eating this. That's too much screen time, that." And at that point, I was like, okay, maybe I should minimize my parenting journey online for Ozma's sake and also because it's nobody's business, really.
Yeah.
I've got people in my life speaking into my parenting who I trust. So, but that was the only time, really. Yeah.
So let's go back to the early days of you becoming a Christian. You give your life to Jesus at a worship event. What happened after that? What difference did it make to your life?
So I went home that night and it was just a normal night, really. But I had prayed this prayer silently. "God, please, would you take my life?" And it was very much like, "I'll give you the brokenness if you'll give me something new." Like a people say this, you can be a new creation. Have it. I'm done with it. Have my life. And I got back. Nothing particularly felt different. I woke up the next day and I just remember feeling that spring feeling, like, oh, it feels good today. And it felt similar to, if you cast your mind back to, are you married?
Yes.
Cast your mind back to when you were just texting or like, it felt like that, like what's today's thing going to be? What will they say to me today? And I just felt like there was this new thing that was like a newness, a freshness. And I felt compelled to find this New Testament I got given at school, this red New Testament by the Gideons.
I had one of those.
The little red book.
The little red book. I think I've still got mine somewhere.
Yeah, I still got mine. I'm telling you, it's like they're sort of strapped into your life somehow. Because I found it in my bottom drawer with my 15-year-old handwriting in the front, Philippa Hannah. And I opened it up and it just was like, wow. Suddenly the words of Jesus just, it felt like they were for me suddenly. They applied to me. God was talking to me as one of his now. And everything that I was asking in my head, I was opening up and finding responses.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
Later that week, I got invited to another event by the friend that I mentioned, by Rue, and another guy called Andy Baker, who went on to be my manager, actually. He's not my manager now, but for 10 years he was. They invited me to this bad taste ball at the Message Trust in Manchester. So we were going to be dressing up in terrible clothes and watching a girl band called TBC do a little bit of their music. So, yeah, I went to that. I sat there. I was the only one who bought a drink in the bar out of 200 Christians. And I remember my Christian friend standing with me in solidarity, like with a glass of Coke while I had half a lager, because I wasn't used to going to any sort of social thing without having a drink of something. So we were standing in the lobby with a drink. And yeah, I was like, this is kind of cool. I like this. But then I watched TBC, Shel Peris, singing songs about young people's identity and worth. And I was like, wow, this has really got value. And I said on the way home in the car, I think I'd really like to do that. Maybe I should contact their team. And Andy Baker really, he kind of gave me a reality check. He was like, Philippa, like, you've literally just got saved.
Yeah.
You might want to just sit with Jesus for a bit and figure that out. And I remember being super offended by that. I was like, I could write songs for TBC. He was like, no, just sit with it for a minute. Mm. Focus on your journey. Which I did. But I threw myself head in first. Went to a church in Sheffield a couple times, really enjoyed it. Found myself somewhere to live with some students there, got involved in the ministry there. Did an Alpha course, which I thought was important because I was like, okay, I need to plug into what is Christianity? Like, I know that Jesus has come into my life, but who is Jesus? And have I been brainwashed or is this real? So thank God for Nicky Gumbel with his, you know, his barrister eloquence and his learned approach to Christianity and the study of Christianity, because that Alpha course was just everything anchoring I needed after having like this Pentecostal born-again experience. You know, I thank God for the Alpha course. Mm. Me and my mum did it together.
Oh, interesting.
And she became no longer a closet Christian, but a very outspoken Christian.
Wow.
And she got baptized. It was such a great journey for me and my mum to go on together. Every week, Nicky Gumbel just prophetically answered questions we'd had. It was amazing. I got really plugged in Sheffield, met my husband about 6 months later, who was a pastor's kid. And, you know, that's a whole story in itself. Because I felt like I didn't really deserve a pastor's kid.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, because I'd just come out of a relationship that was not very healthy. That whole journey had been crazy. My teenage years had been crazy. Mm. I was very liberal and experimental in every way.
So you just kind of felt like, oh, like you're a really good kid and you've been brought up in this really strict Christian environment and I'm obviously too worldly and soiled or whatever for you. Like, this is not going to work.
100%.
Wow.
And I actually said that to him because he invited me out on a coffee date.
Yeah.
Which I naively thought was just him wanting to get to know me because I was new to the area. And also, I don't know, people in the world, we just don't think that deeply about going for a coffee with someone because, I don't know, maybe people do and I just don't. I didn't think anything of it. But he said on that first meeting, I've been praying and I just think God's really revealed you as my wife.
Wow. That's a way in.
So I thought, this poor little pastor's kid, he's got no idea. And I thought, well, you know, we would have to take this really slow if we were going to do it anyway. But secondly, I felt like I had to fill him in, you know. The way you've lived your life is not the way I've lived mine. This was his first ever date. I had just finished a relationship where I'd lived with someone for 2 years and it had been a very consuming relationship. So I felt like I had to do a disclaimer of like, here's all the things that I've done that you probably haven't done. And you probably deserve somebody who's got a bit more, you know, Christianity under their belt than I have. And he just laughed. Like, he just was like, listen, you're a new creation in Christ. And I see, like, an amazing woman of God in front of me.
Wow.
Which was quite amazing.
That's, like, almost, like, prophetic. Like, he's speaking almost what God sees you as, like, over you.
He is prophetic.
Yeah.
He's a really quiet guy, a man of few words, but he's prophetic. And if he feels something, the only time you'll ever see him really step out, like, he's such a background person, but occasionally, like randomly, he'll just have a prophetic word for someone. And so I kind of took what he said, like, seriously. Thought, okay, maybe he's right. So that night, he took me to his church. We went to this, like, youth thing, because he was only 19, I was 20, just about to turn 21, and he was only 19. Took me to this young adults thing, and seeing him in that environment, he was just so steady. He was just such a steadfast, steady human, and I was so comfortable in the quietness of his spirit. Like, he was such a gentle human. I thought I could get used to this.
Yeah, that felt like something you needed in your life.
100%. And we, for about 3 or 4 months, just hung out in a very gentle way. And eventually we decided to make it official.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, bless. How long have you been married now?
16 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you feel like there was any sort of deep soul healing that you needed to do after you became a Christian? Did that sense of, like, potentially not being good enough for your husband cross over at all in the way you saw yourself before God? Or was it sort of very instant, sort of, no, that's all gone and I'm fine now?
It was a process, because the soul can be completely healed, like the inner self can be made completely whole, but you've still got muscle memory and you've still got trauma and you've still got, I mean, maybe some people are delivered instantly from all their trauma, but I've not met many people who would say that. Most people still have some things that lay dormant until they're awoken, like by marriage or by the issues that marriage can throw up. And even by becoming a mum, you know, I think even becoming a mum forced immediately, I wasn't ready for this, but when I became a mum, my childhood came back hugely, you know, remembering how my parents communicated with each other, how they did parenting, my relationship with my mum and dad, both of them. So I think, you know, we're continually being made, aren't we? Being transformed into the likeness of Christ. And so, yeah, there have been some core moments, some key moments, one of which was about 2 years into our marriage. And I'd been on my best behavior, more or less, with, you know, with conflict resolution and just everything, really. And then I got into a massive fight with my sister in front of Joel. I was around my sister's house. I can't remember what it was about. It was something little, but you know what sisters are like, or can be like, we can regress pretty quickly to being childish. And it was a huge, huge fight. It was like the kind of fight where you think, wow, we might not talk for a while. It was one of them. And I just remember, like, as it was happening, I just was so aware of his eyes on me. And I suddenly felt like, I think that added to it. It added, the embarrassment added to how vile I was being. And I ended up just sort of locking myself in the spare room, not wanting to talk to anyone. And he sort of like broke in and wouldn't leave me alone. And I was sort of in the fetal position, and he got in bed beside me and just held me, said, I'm not going anywhere. Like, he just had this calmness about him. I've never forgotten that moment, because I was like, okay, so this is what actual unconditional love looks like. This is what it looks like when we're at our least attractive.
Yeah.
Somebody who'll be like, I'm still here. Like, you can fight away the love, but it's still going to be there. And it was a really good example to me of what actual Christianity is, you know, what God's heart actually looks like.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You journey through life, that different things happen that make you either learn something new about yourself or deal with something that's happened to you that you thought you dealt with that maybe you hadn't. And that the grace of God in those times to give us other humans to journey through that with is really beautiful. It's really lovely to hear you talk that. You do have like a rather large and complicated family, and you were sharing some of this on social media last year that you actually found your long lost brother. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, Peter. It's so crazy, even if I think about it now. This time last year, a year ago to the month, I'd been away, done a few shows and had a backlog of emails to get through. And I was looking through the emails and saw one that said, looking for Pat Hannah, which is my dad's name. And thought, okay, well, that's definitely not something I need to look at now. I need to answer the email about next week's event and the email about whatever. I've had a few emails like that over the years, people looking for both my parents, childhood friends, or, you know, people who used to work with them. And as I'd scanned over the email, I saw Marine's show band in there, which is the band that my dad used to be in his teens and 20s. And I know that he's had a reunion with those guys before. So I just figured it was somebody he used to be in a band with, trying to find it. Didn't really read the email. My husband found it, though, because he gets my info at emails as well. And he caught the email and he said, Philippa, did you read that email? I said, no, not really. I will. Thinking, get off my case. I've just got back. And he's like, no, I think you should really read that one. Like, you know, just read it. I was like, okay. He said, I've sent it to your mum. I was like, why have you sent it to my mum? Carried on unpacking my suitcase or whatever. And the next day he was working at church, my husband, and he texted me and said, Philippa, read that email. And I said, okay, what's this all about? He said, look, I've been in touch with the guy who sent the email. Can you call me? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll call you. But before I called him, I read the email. I read the email and it said, look, hey, life is funny, isn't it? In 1966, I was adopted in Northern Ireland. And in the 90s, my birth mother found me, reached out to me, and we met and got to know each other. And she told me back then that my father was someone called Pat Hannah, and that he was the guitarist in her band. And so, hey, I can't be sure, but we might be related. It's like, I'm joining the dots here, related. It sounds like you're saying you're my brother. And he said, anyway, here's my number. Please contact me if you'd like to. It'd be good to have a chat and see if we can figure this out. And I looked at the name at the bottom of the email. It said Peter Cunner. And underneath that, the footer said D-Ream. And I'm a musician, so I know D-Ream is a band. I remember D-Ream from the
90s. Yeah, I remember D-Ream from the 90s.
Things can only get better.
I'm glad you sang it and
pretty,
not me.
I know you wanted me to. Pretty huge song.
Yeah.
Huge song. Huge hit song. And they'd had other songs as well. So I thought that actually made it seem less like a mistake because everybody in my family is musical.
Yeah,
everybody.
Yeah. You've got cousins that are in a band. Yeah. Your brother was part of Jamiroquai, is that right?
My brother played bass for Jamiroquai. Yeah. He was one of the founding members. He's been a worldwide successful bass player and songwriter. And, you know, my other cousins, Embrace, they had really good success in the 90s as well. Everybody on my dad's side of the family is hugely musical. So I thought, well, look, I'm going to Google image search D-Ream. Looked at D-Ream and found that Peter is actually the lead singer of D-Ream and he looks a lot like my dad. Can you imagine? I'm looking at it thinking,
wow,
okay, this is interesting. So I called my parents. I asked my dad, does this ring a bell? And he didn't think that it did. Like he just said, you know, the lead singer of the band, her name was Anne. She's still around, Anne. She had been going out with the bass player of the band. He didn't remember them having a relationship. So I was like, okay. So I spoke to Peter and I delivered the bad news that my dad didn't think that it was the case. But the good news was I had done Ancestry DNA for fun, like 3 or 4 years before. Actually, it was a long time ago. It was 2018 I did it. I did it for my YouTube, like as a thing. I was doing this series at the time called Inspiration 365. Did a DNA test to see if there was anything exotic in my past. But the exotic wasn't in my past. It was in my dad's past, clearly. So I was like, listen, if you do an Ancestry DNA test, Pete, you'll find out. You'll see if we're a match. And so he did. And we are.
Wow.
Yeah, so it turns out he's my brother.
Oh, my days. That's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
And you've since been over, you've met with him, he's met your daughter. So I'm guessing that was a sort of a fairly peaceable reunion.
Amazing, yeah. Well, both of us, like all of us, had a good sense of humour about it. The minute we found out about it, I started researching him, watching all his old interviews, all his old music videos. One of the perks to having like famous phantom siblings is that you can research them. So I was like, oh my gosh, it's crazy. He's always been a musician. He grew up in a family that wasn't particularly musical, but he picked up guitar and was fantastic at it. He has a guitar that looks very much like mine, a Gretsch White Falcon. We all love country music. His first gig he went to was Johnny Cash, which I was raised on as well.
Wow.
So we connected pretty well straight away, and my dad's such a gentle, lovely guy. He came over to meet dad. It was emotional. It is a lot to take in. Mm. My dad did say, like, this is an awful lot to take in. Mm. One of the things that was a little sad about it is, you know, he's 59. He's turning 60 this year. So I'm like, okay, that's a whole lifetime that I've missed of this person.
Yeah.
But all we can do now is pick it up from where we are.
Yeah. And how does your faith play into that? Does it help to have a faith to rely on in times like that, which could be tricky emotionally?
It made me think a couple of things. I mean, firstly, when the idea of God just planting music into a bloodline and just thinking of how, even though he's raised outside of the pack in a non-musical environment, it's been irrevocable. Mm. He's ended up a full-time musician. And it's also made me just super honoured that I am the first Christian musician in my family, which I love the fact that God has steered the bloodline right now. It's crazy. And also just knowing that God's timing is perfect. So I'll accept this narrative, even though it's a bit unusual. There's lots to learn from it about identity, family, adoption, even how beautiful it is that his family have loved and raised him so well, even though they've no blood connection with him. That's beautiful. Adoption is a running theme in Christianity, isn't it?
Mm.
So
yeah, we're adopted into a wider family when we become Christians. And my story is pretty similar to yours. I became a Christian as a teenager, as the first person in my family, and I really felt that like love and care of a Christian community that gathered around me, even when my own family were in a bit of crisis. So yeah, I think that is a really beautiful part of the Christian faith, isn't it? Let's talk about country music, because obviously this is very close to your heart, and it is something of a resurgence in recent years. I read the other day that country music is the fastest growing genre of music being streamed in the UK right now, and has an increasing audience amongst younger people. Why do you think young people are suddenly turning back to country music?
It's all Post Malone's fault, clearly. I don't know. Country music's always been great, always been cool, huge in America and other territories. I think storytelling is really engaging. And I think they're just good songs. Like, country music has always had the best songwriters, in my opinion, in terms of, like, the craft of storytelling through a song. It's, you know, I think country is kind of unparalleled.
It's interesting that the Christian music epicenter of the world and the country music epicenter of the world are both Nashville, isn't it? So there obviously is just, like you say, that real craft of storytelling that's sort of embedded in both music genres.
Isn't it interesting as well, I don't know if you know this, but the reason Nashville is Nashville, is Music City, is because of radio. There was one of the earliest radio stations broadcast out of there because the whatever the bandwidth was great, or the signal was great or something. So because the radio was there and it was the most popular radio place, that's what drew all the studios, that's what drew all the artists, and then maybe that's what drew all the Christians as well.
Maybe. And so tell us what you've got going on musically at the moment, because I know you've got some new projects in the pipeline.
Yeah, I made a record last August, straight after Big Church Festival, with Israel Houghton. We made a record together, and we've been dripping out singles for the last couple of months, and the album comes out in May 22nd.
And you actually wrote for Premier Christianity magazine a little while ago that Israel was one of your own musical heroes. Tell us about the impact that he had on your life and why it was so special to record with him.
He's amazing. He's like, he doesn't like to be called a fairy, but he is like a fairy godfather. He is. He's like an answer to prayer. He's like a miracle. So it's amazing to be affirmed by anyone, but to be affirmed by somebody whom you respect and regard so highly, musically, you know, he's just phenomenal. He's phenomenally talented and phenomenally anointed as a minister, a worship leader. So I remember saying to my people at Integrity Music, they asked, is there any bucket list people you'd like to write with? And me not thinking that, you know, they would ever manage to pull that off, I was like, well, obviously, Israel. Who wouldn't want to write with Israel? But I'm guessing that's probably out of the question. But yeah, write it down. Stick it in your back pocket. And then he came over the year before last to the UK, and he made time to write with a couple of writers, and I was one of them. So we sat in a room, we wrote a song. The song was great. And we didn't put it on the album, though. There's probably 20 songs we didn't put on the album that we wrote.
Wow.
But I just felt like he could see me. Like, he could see, he's a musician's musician, so I think he gets my musicality. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but even in churches, like, you can really tell a musician, like someone who's a lifelong muso from birth. And I think he just really saw that in me. And also the fact that having come from a non-Christian background, there's a rawness and a realness about how I talk and share things. Not overly religious or too indoctrinated in church talk, church ways. I think we are gifted with so many fantastic worship leaders that have grown up in church, but I'm really, really grateful that I've got experience on both sides of the fence, because it just brings with it an awareness. So we connected and wrote a bunch of songs, and he was going to produce the album, but he was in the room and he was kind of being a maestro in the room. So I was like, when we looked back at the project and listened back to it, it just sounded so much like a bunch of mates worshipping. I was like, this is not just a Philippa Hannah record. This is definitely a Philippa and Israel thing. So that's what it is.
Oh, that's really beautiful. And when's that come out?
22nd of May.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So people can pick it up then.
Yeah.
So reflecting on your experience in church and feeling that sometimes it might be a little bit sanitized, what has your experience been as someone who's come from the outside in into bringing your whole self into the church space? Is there more that you think needs to be done around the areas of anxiety and depression and mental health in church, or have you had a very positive experience of that?
People like talking about it, and everyone's getting better at talking about it. I think one of the things we struggle with is just pastoring humans. And also having church full of volunteers that are human. I think mistakes sometimes are made in how we do that. Even just how we do church, I think we've got a long way to go. How it looks, how it sounds, how it's structured. I think I travel around lots of different types of churches. Mm. About 10 years ago, we counted that I'd done 1,500 appearances.
Wow.
Most of them would have been in churches. And that was about 10 years ago. So I'm guessing I've probably been close to 1,800, 2,000 churches now. Some of them will be repeats. So let's say conservatively, I've been to 1,000 churches. Everybody's doing something right. Everybody's doing something wrong. And there's lots we can all learn from different denominations and expressions of church. The church I go to is a large church. Some might even call it a mega church. And they're a phenomenal fruit that comes from that, you know, in terms of how many Easter eggs we can give away at Easter, you know, the amount of resource we have, how many people we can welcome even on a Sunday morning is incredible, and what we can offer up for them. But, you know, I've been to the tiniest churches where I just feel like some of the most incredible community takes place. It's a bit like being a friend as well, the hospitality. We've got different friends that do it different ways, right?
Mm.
We've got friends who've got impeccably clean homes, beautiful candles. They've got incredible ornament game. They've got, you know, spectacular hors d'oeuvres they serve. And God bless them, because I love going to those houses. But, you know, when I just want to be myself and kick my shoes off and put my hair in a messy bun, I've got other friends that I go to those houses for, you know, and you just feel like you go to those houses and you're like, it makes you feel better about your own house. I think that's a good model. That's a good illustration of church, isn't it? So we want to be there somehow doing the best of what we can. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that interesting juxtaposition, isn't it, between the pursuit of excellence for the glory of God and creating somewhere where people can come with all of their real messiness, and trying to create a place where that coexists is actually really challenging. I would never want to be a church leader.
I think that sounds
really difficult, but there is something beautiful about creating those places where people can come with their whole lives, good, bad, ugly, and everything in the middle, isn't there? So as we just wrap up, I just want to ask you now, you have a daughter of your own. What would be your hope and dream for a future for her that, you know, avoids some of the stuff that you went through? What is it that as a parent you're really hoping that you can pass on to the next generation?
Well, listen, I think we, as parents, we can easily swing the pendulum far in the other direction from where we've been. So I'm aware of that. Ozma is in a Christian school, and that's a high priority to me because I want her to have the education where she learns about her identity in Christ. They spend a lot of time at school, and so it matters to me what they hear when they're there. So that's a key priority for me. But having said that, I don't want her to be sheltered to the point of where she can't sit down and talk to Muslim children or, you know, hang out with the kids that don't necessarily come from that background. So it's interesting, isn't it? I'm praying I strike the balance, but I think I'm never going to put her through school if it doesn't if it doesn't jive with her, because the school system is limited, I think, where it comes to neurodivergent children, or children that just show special interests in music and things like that. She's very much like me. So she's probably got ADHD. She might be a little autistic. I don't want her to be labelled, but I want a life that works for her. So I'm prepared to do anything to make sure she enjoys her childhood, and that includes school. So that's something I'm praying about most days.
Yeah, it's amazing how much parenthood improves your prayer life. That would be, I would say, my takeaway from 2 decades as a mother.
Wow.
It improves your prayer life a lot. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Philippa. It's been brilliant to talk about such a huge array of topics. So thank you for sharing your life so vulnerably and being prepared to get stuck in all that. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, especially considering that I got the wrong day. You're a very gracious,
lovely human. All's well that ends well. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Quality proteins aren't just for special occasions. With Omaha Steaks, you get mouth-watering proteins delivered right to your door, individually packaged and portioned, so a great dinner is just minutes away. From Taco Tuesday to a weekend feast, taste the Omaha Steaks difference. Start getting flavorful proteins delivered today. Visit omahasteaks.com and get $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code AUDIO. Terms apply. See site for details.